I really like that I get to play the role of guy who doesn't know anything because I'm gonna play that role pretty well tonight. This paper looks cool, and I'm really excited to actually understand it.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of In Plain English. I'm your host, Jamie Moffa, and today we are going to be talking about the paper. An ankylosaur larynx provides insights for bird-like vocalization in non-avian dinosaurs by Junki Yoshida et al. And here to discuss this paper with us is Jimmy Waldron from Dinosaurs Will Always Be Awesome. Jimmy, do you want to give a brief introduction?
Hello, thank you so much for having me. It's an absolute delight to be here. But yeah, my name is Jimmy Waldron. I am the founder of Dinosaurs Will Always Be Awesome, which started off as a podcast and has kind of evolved into a few new things as well. We deliver mobile museum experiences to communities that don't have access to natural history museums of their own. And so I bring real and replica fossils and dinosaurs like my friend Poe here out to help kids and adults capture the wonder of these amazing animals.
That is so cool. I'm so excited to have you on.
Thrill's all mine. Thank you so much.
And then our first guest for today is Liam Gusios. Liam, would you like to introduce yourself?
Yeah, absolutely. Excited to be here. It's awesome to be on. I think I first really got interested in dinosaurs when I convinced my mom to let me buy a VHS copy of Jurassic Park for $5 at the local library.
Nice. And then our second guest is Ashley Hamer. Ashley, would you like to introduce yourself?
Yeah, sure. I am Ashley Hamer. I am a podcaster. I was the former host of the daily science podcast Curiosity Daily. And right now I am doing my own podcast called Taboo Science, which is all about the answering the questions you're not allowed to ask. And I'm excited to be here.
That is awesome. So, Jimmy, why don't you take it away with an introduction to this paper?
I will be delighted to do that, Jimmy. Thank you so much. Oh, this paper today that we're going to take a look at, I'm so excited about. This has answered a bunch of new questions and also created so many more in the process, what good science really needs to do. So this is an open access paper, which means everybody listening to this can download this right now and follow along because we want to keep our science open because that's what encourages critical thinking and expanding on ideas. But we're looking at the larynx of an ankylosaur, a specific dinosaur called Panacosaurus grangeri. And so if you think of an ankylosaur, that's one of those creatures that is like a walking tank. It's got armor plates down its back, and it's got a big club tail in many of the species. Not all of them do, but most of them do. So Panacosaurus is a kind of ankylosaur that lived in what is now Mongolia. So it was a neighbor of famous creatures like Velociraptor and Therizinosaurus and a bunch of other really cool dinosaurs that lived out there in places called the Flaming Cliffs of the Gobi Desert. Really exciting stuff. So what makes this paper so incredibly special is that we have found for the first time structures that have not typically fossilized before. So when you think of things that turn into fossils, you talk about stuff like bones and claws, the hard materials that can be mineralized and replaced with sediments over time. And usually the softer stuff like skin and muscles and cartilage don't stick around too long for fossilization. But in this case, in this very special case for this little Panacosaurus, we actually have some really well-preserved soft tissues from the neck area. And one of the pieces that they found is the larynx or the voice box. What makes this so unique is that we don't typically find those kind of things. We have found a few before, but not as crisp and not as cleanly preserved as this. So there are two particular components that make up a larynx or a voice box. You've got a ring of cartilage called the cricoid, and we have it too. And then there's another function called the arytenoid, which is another cartilaginous flap on the sides that your vocal cords actually attach to. So as I'm saying this right now, my arytenoids are going crazy, pulling back and forth to make all the different sounds and shapes that you're hearing. When we found this in Panacosaurus, the structures of it let us see that it actually formed and was functional very similar to that of talkative birds, as opposed to what many scientists had thought, in which that many dinosaurs were more reptilian in the way that they communicated. And so it really opens up a lot of really exciting potential for how the world of dinosaurs may have sounded on top of everything else. So it's a very exciting paper to get into.
Can I ask just like a basic question?
Sure.
If we think that, you know, if we're surprised that these reptilian dinosaurs have voice boxes more like birds. Can you explain the difference between reptilian dinosaurs and avian dinosaurs?
Sure. Well, so there's a couple things we got to put together first. So right now, in your mind, I want you to draw a circle. And inside of that circle, I want you to put every reptile you can think of. So snakes and alligators, turtles, mosasaurs, pterosaurs, anything that is scaly and has a non-so-boobable snoot. All right, so inside of that big circle, now I want you to draw a smaller circle. And inside that smaller circle, we're going to put all the dinosaurs. So everything from T-Rex to Triceratops, Velociraptor, all those in between, Pinacosaurus is right there too. So now, we got our reptile circle and we got our dinosaur circle. We're going to go one step lower now and we're going to make a circle that has every bird in it. So everything from chickens, pigeons, cassowaries, all those guys inside of this circle here. Using the properties of like early geometry, you know, like every square is a rectangle, but not every rectangle is a square. That means that every dinosaur is a reptile, but not all reptiles are dinosaurs. So alligators and snakes and turtles are on the outside of that circle. The dinosaurs are kinds of reptiles. Now, inside that dinosaur circle, it means the birds are kinds of dinosaurs. So every bird is a dinosaur, but not every dinosaur is a bird. That's my blowing. And if you talk to my buddy Neil Shubin, we're all just weird looking fish anyhow. So this whole stack of things, like how everything relates, is all, it's all pretty crazy. So we have two different kinds of dinosaurs that we can talk about here. We classify them in all different kinds of ways. We've been classifying dinosaurs in a number of different ways since the 1850s when someone first figured out that there was a weird kind of creature here. But the one I want to focus on here is avian dinosaurs versus non-avian dinosaurs. And one of the ways that we can tell the avian dinosaurs apart is the structure of their feet. Avian theropods, it means beast feet, like Poe here, have three clawed toes. Raptors, T-Rexes, all the carnivores have those three clawed toes. And the structures of their legs and their long muscles and their hollow bones are all intensely... these are all things that are found consistent among the avian theropods. The creatures that were in the same branch of the family tree that Poe and the other raptors are, we call them the Maniraptora. And they would split off eventually to give rise to what we call the Paravis. And those split off again into becoming the avies, or the modern-day birds. So every modern-day bird that lives today is a descendant and a close relative of all the carnivorous dinosaurs. And they are dinosaurs, in fact, themselves, right? So then we have our non-avian dinosaurs. And so the ones that don't have those same feet aren't part of that same lineage. That's going to be most of the other types of dinosaurs. So like Triceratops, Stegosaurus, Brontosaurus. Those folks are not in the avian lineage, so they are not related to the modern day birds, even though some of them literally have parrot faces. So like when we talk about the avian versus the non-avian dinosaurs, that's kind of the gap we're going for here. Now, to get back to your question about the larynx, reptiles, in many cases, are pretty communicative. We have a lot of alligators here in Florida, and we have a couple of alligator sanctuaries. If you go to visit those sanctuaries at certain times of the day, or certain times of the year, when it's alligator mating season, they make these big, girthy bellows. Like the alligator will take up all this air inside of its body and then just press itself under the water. And it's, just like, it's like a very deep reverberation, and you can hear it for a long way. But it's how they reach out to attract mates. Their larynx is the only way that they control the flow of air. Now, birds, for example, they have that same larynx, but they also have something else called a syrinx, which is manipulating the way the air comes out, which is why we get different tones. Another way to think of it is the difference between a set of bagpipes and a whoopee cushion. So you got one is this thing that makes really rude sounds and you wouldn't use it in polite conversation. It's inappropriate for most circumstances. And the other one is a whoopee cushion. The whoopee cushion has one basic sound that it makes. You can adjust it a little bit, like if you squeeze the end or you pull it a little bit so you can make it more squeaky instead of... But the bagpipes, same premise. We're pressing a bladder full of air and we're changing the tones of it as it comes out with the like the flute extensions and the parts where the bagpipes are. So the bagpipes are like bird voices and the whoopee cushion is like an alligator voice. What we find is that because of the orientation of those different muscles and those different pieces, the cricoid and the arytenoids in the Pinacosaurus, Pinacosaurus had bagpipes instead of whoopee cushions.
So, I mean, this begs the question, humans, we have whoopee cushions, right?
No, actually, we have really complex vocal cords as well. And so we have a larynx, and we also have this extra section of our whole situation up here is very complicated in our trachea, because we have the gap with like the epiglottis to make sure that food doesn't go down into the breathing hole, because everything's right there together. And so we have multiple muscles that are able to pull and to adjust our vocal cords very fine-tuned. And so ours, being mammals, we're not really part of the same conversation. And so ours are more complicated alongside birds. But they're more complicated than reptiles. So one of the things that I thought was really cool about the way they did this is actually a sequel to an initial study done in 2015 when the Pinacosaurus specimen was first discovered. Now, when they first found it, they realized, hey, this is a really small skull for this particular type of animal, but it's really well preserved. There's a whole bunch of stuff here that we would like to continue doing research on. And then from 2015 until now, it's been under really delicate and deliberate preparation and CT scanning and just constant review and analysis, just to make sure that when they found something worth talking about, that they were able to cover all the different bases. So you can see, if you're following along this, on page 2 of the study, you can actually see the picture of what all those individual parts look like. So you can see where in the lower jaw. So this is the Pinacosaurus right here. All right, because I have to have props. And so on the underside of the neck, right around midway down the neck, is where we start to see those individual components that make up the voice box. You can see in the actual study graphic that it's like a triangle shape. It almost looks like a scoot or like a shark's tooth stuck underneath the jaw. That's one of the things that makes it stand out so much. Because like, why is this here? It's not something we normally see. But it's like a triangle shape. My fingers here actually make a really good depiction of it, because they're kind of like deep check marks or big angles, and they're open in the middle because these would be the things that attach on either side of the windpipe. And then you can see there's the two smaller pieces that are the actual arytenoids, so the parts that actually manipulate back and forth. As you go through this, you see that they studied another 74 individual animals, alive and extinct, to say, okay, we have this idea, we have this hypothesis, science thrives on repetition, so let's see if we can get the same results looking at other creatures that are alive today and things that were alive back then. And so when they compared them to other kinds of birds, they found that the length of the arytenoid compared to the rest of the structure of Pinacosaurus was very similar to that of other birds and way different from the non-avian reptiles, so totally different from like turtles and things like that. And then they found then when you looked at the length and the width of the cricoid, that it was also very similar to birds. We find that the structures, as they show up, are very similar to those of modern-day birds and other more song-creating creatures. Now, we also compared that with different kinds of turtles, because there are some turtles that do make noise and some turtles that are very quiet. So like deep marine turtles, like soft-shell long-neck turtles, they don't really say too much. But shoreline turtles and tortoises that live on the land can often make really funny sounds and stuff like that too. If you ever seen one of those videos of a turtle trying to mate with a shoe, they can get very vocal. The vocal structures of those kinds of talkative turtles are very similar, both in their comparative width and length, as what we find here in the Pinacosaurus as well. So when we create these different lines of correlation between the size and the shape of the different organs, and how they compare to other creatures that we know make sound and that we know do not, it paints a really clear picture that this was a pretty talkative creature.
So I feel like, and again, this is with my limited knowledge of dinosaurs, I feel like general culture has been pretty on board with the idea of just, you know, dinosaurs to birds, which granted was over a pretty long time frame. And when you look at, you know, feathered dinosaurs, avian dinosaurs, and you look at a bird, at least what I do, I can see, you know, kind of point A to point B. And in my mind, that makes sense. When I looked at a picture of the Pinacosaurus, it doesn't look like a bird, at least not to me. So does this shift how we think about how birds evolved from dinosaurs, or is this just a dinosaur that also kind of happens to sound like a bird?
That's an excellent question, Liam. I love that. So a lot of what we have to look at here is that dinosaurs lived on this planet so much longer than we ever did. You know, so we have like Tyrannosaurus rex, for example, only lived in a very shallow amount of the late Cretaceous period, only lived for about 5 million years, which is roughly 3.5 million years longer than the earliest, human-like hominid has been discovered. Over the course of the time that these different generations of dinosaurs lived, you know, all the paces of natural selection were well underway. So creatures had traits that were more attractive or more efficient for catching food or avoiding predation. And so they got rewarded by being able to make baby dinosaurs. And so over time, those traits become more prevalent and they become more essential for survival. Along with that, think about how many creatures are alive in the world right now. You know, if you're walking around past your apartment, how many different kinds of birds do you see? How many different kinds of bugs and turtles and things? Not counting like, you know, dogs and pets and other stuff like that, but just think of all the wildlife and all the existing things that are around us right now. Every single living creature occupies a distinct ecological niche and has a role in the environment, whether it's to consume something or to produce something or to break it all down afterwards. All these jobs need to be filled, ecologically speaking. And they were still hiring for these jobs 75 million years ago, too. And so when we find these things where it's like we have this broad, huge, open world with these creatures that needed to communicate with each other, whether to find their herd or to warn of danger or to help with like mating process and things like that, having the ability to communicate for dominant organisms like these would have been a really essential tool. We're just now finding out more about how they work. And that's the process of science, is learning new information and then factoring that data in. So the presence of this doesn't necessarily change our understanding of how birds evolved, but it does give us a little bit more insight to how the process of vocalization evolved. Because now we can see creatures with demonstrated equipment to make these things happen. I would love to see, and I'm sure it'll come out here pretty soon, where someone, the model, the CT scan of these structures is available on MorphoBank right now. The people who produced the study, in addition to making an open access paper, also released all the data they got. So you can get 3D models of a Panachosaurus head, you can get the 3D models of the cricoid and the arytenoids. I want someone to try and make these out of like soft materials and try to make a talking Panachosaurus puppet of some kind. We did something like this about 20 years ago with Parasaurolophus. It's got that big tube crest on the top of its head, the big trombone. And we found out that those bones were hollow and they connected to the nasal passages. So in trying to figure out what is the purpose, what is the function of this structure, we found that if we blew air through it, it made a sound. And so it was right after The Lost World came out, the second Jurassic Park movie. I remember seeing on the news, like, hey, you want to hear what a real dinosaur sounds like? And they would have this structure, this model that they built of a paraskull, and they would just blow air through it. It just sounded like this big bleeding, like honk, like this. It's like, that's a dinosaur, huh? He's like, I mean, it's the sound that's made when you blow through it. So it was unrefined, but it was distinctive. So taking something like that and combining it now with, hey, we have this adjustable point here, we could give us a little bit more insight to the actual sounds that dinosaurs made.
They did something similar to that with a mummy a few years ago, right? It was like, it sounded so weird that it became an internet meme. It'd be great to do that with a dinosaur.
I remember hearing that story as well. It's one of those things like, well, there's no way this could possibly bring about a curse.
Exactly.
So let's just go nuts.
Does this change how we think about the way that all dinosaurs could have, I guess for lack of a better word, talked? Or is there still, and granted, this is with the understanding that, like, obviously dinosaurs were a long time ago, we can't just, like, ask them. Does this appear to be maybe more of a one-off or more of its own lane? Or does this change how we think about how every dinosaur might have communicated and vocalized?
It is not a one-off scenario. We have found these kinds of structures in one way, shape, or form before in a number of other kind of dinosaurs. We have found them in things like Microraptor, which is like a small little theropod, Confuciusornis, which is another, a lot of small ones. Look kind of like a cross between a goose and a velociraptor. It's got a longer neck. It's got little bird-like arms and little claws and things like that. And then one that you may have heard of called Carnotaurus, which is the meat-eating bull, about 10 feet tall, lived in Argentina, and it's called an abelosaur. It's got big horns on top of its head and tiny little useless arms, so vestigial they didn't even have claws on the end of them. T-Rex gets a lot of grief for having small arms, but Carnotaurus can't even text anything. So we have found similar structures in all of those kinds of creatures. And so that what it does here is that it gives us new avenues to ask why and how, with supported evidence to kind of guide us down some of those questions. It takes away the idea of there's a hypothesis that had been going around for a while that early Earth was pretty silent because there was no physical evidence that they could really put together that dinosaurs could make sounds at all. And so maybe they didn't make sounds. And so a lot of people are like, we don't know that they did, so we're just going to say they don't until we find something else. This is that something else. So now we know. We don't know what it sounded like, but the fact that we're finding these vocalization structures in many different kinds of dinosaurs that didn't even live in the same part of the world tells us that our planet was very chirpy. Not quite so roary.
I was going to say, so they probably didn't roar. Like the big T-Rex roar you kind of think of probably wasn't a thing.
So Tyrannosaurus's neck, T-Rex has been studied extensively in so many different areas, and we don't find a whole heck of a lot of specimens of them. We've only got about 32 or 34 T-Rexes that we can actually see. They are so robust and so strong and so massive that we've learned a lot about this particular creature. The roar, the iconic roar from Jurassic Park, was a combination of a lion, an alligator rumble, and a baby elephant that was just freaking out one day. And so they took all those sounds, manipulated them in a sound system back in 1992, and created that distinctive sound that we associate with T-Rex to this very day. Because those sounds were mostly derived from mammals, there's a very strong chance that T-Rex did not sound like that big T-Rex. Now, I don't like people who come out and say, hey, it just sounded like a big goose. They just honked. They weren't that scary. No, you got to give some dramatic flair to this animal. T-Rex had massive jaws. Its skull weighed about 1,400 pounds on its own and had a massive meaty neck with almost like a flap underneath that would allow it to kind of catch huge gulps of prey on the way down. The new season, well, the last paleo documentary that came out of the prehistoric planet on Apple TV Plus did a wonderful rendition of what T-Rex looked like and sounded like. They kind of gave it a combination of reptilian, that big gurgle that an alligator would have, but also added in a little bit of some deep bird vocal rutting. Because there are some birds that make really deep sounds too. And so by combining those two relative sounds, you find something that kind of meets in the middle. And so whether or not T-Rex probably didn't roar this way it sounded in Jurassic Park, but I bet if you heard it, you'd wish that you didn't.
Do you think we'll start changing the way we represent the way dinosaurs sound in popular media?
I'd like to think so. You know, if we take things like 65, for example, which is just pure popcorn sci-fi fun, they weren't striving for authenticity in their dinosaurs. They were striving for something that looks cool. And so if the rule of cool continues and people don't start to see things like this amazing, you know, feathered theropod as being the complete ultimate badass that she is, then you're not going to see quite as much representation in that. Now, I will say that those paleo docs that are combination of informative and dramatic at the same time can really make people think, wow, that Mononychus that looks like a barn owl is pretty adorable. I bet, you know, other dinosaurs look like that too. Or the velociraptors were still looking very cunning while they were covered in feathers head to toe. And so I'd like to see some more of those things coming up. The biggest change that we'll see going forward is another study that just came out a few days ago proving that Tyrannosaurus and other theropods had lips. And that settled yet another debate. This is like a breaking news, unless you already knew it, kind of thing. So there have been two camps for a very long time about whether or not dinosaurs had lips. You know, think T-Rex, for example, has massive teeth, They extend down past the lower jaw. All dinosaurs continually replace their teeth throughout their lifetime, and they use those basically instead of hands. So they needed their teeth to be ready sharp all the time. T-Rex's teeth would push out and a new one would come into its place. And so the idea of them having lips in many people's eyes would just kind of get in the way. They'd be constantly biting their lower lips off by pushing out these new teeth. When we look at lips in the mammalian sense, it doesn't make sense because our lips are really soft and they're made to help with vocalization and things like that, among other things. But when we look at the jaws and the lips of reptiles, we see that they are really there just to kind of help keep the mouth protected and to prevent, you know, things from drying out or from bacteria from getting in. We look at the lower jaw, or we look at the upper jaw of T-Rex and lower jaw too, and they've got these little holes all down the lines of the side of the jaws. We call those foramina. They're little openings where blood vessels can come through. Now, we've known that those were there for a very long time, but the question of what were they there for was something that was really interesting. Some scientists hypothesized that those were for sensory organs. And so like some alligators, when they can, in really dark water, they can bump their mouth into something else and they can sense that things are there. Or like the Jacobson's organ of a snake that allows it to kind of detect heat and other things around there. They thought maybe the T-Rex could detect things around with these little bumps on its jaw. And other people are like, well, no, that's really just where blood vessels come through because it's got lips and you need to have a blood supply to the lips. We can't have those teeth just sitting out in the open all the time. And so the new study from about a week or so ago really found some deep hard evidence, some preserved tissue that had been fully studied and analyzed and drew comparisons between reptiles, tyrannosaurs, and other theropods, and even some modern birds, and found that no, those holes are blood supply to lips. We actually have the presence of the lips here. So think of it like they're more reptilian looking lips, so they'd be like lizard lips. Not very good for smooching or anything like that, but good for protecting their mouth.
So like lips is just meaning like soft tissue in front of the teeth.
Yes.
Okay. I'm like really having a hard time not picturing people lips on a T-Rex.
Listen, after that news dropped, there are so many paleontology meme accounts out there. That image exists now. You can find plenty of pictures of super smoochy tyrannosaurs.
Are there any reptiles that don't have lips? It seems like a weird thing to assume about a dinosaur if we don't know of any now that don't have lips, right?
No. So, all right, I'll give you one second. Give you a quick example. So this is the skull of Velociraptor, and this is a life-size skull. So they weren't six-foot turkeys. They were turkey-sized turkeys. And you can see here along the edge, those are the foramina I was talking about. So those little holes along the outside of the skull that provide blood to lip tissue. And you can also see these marks along the, these deep grooves that go down the side of the skull. And those are muscle attachment points. So we know that there was some kind of buckle or lip-like motion that was available there. This is the classic Jurassic Park T-Rex. And when its mouth is closed, those giant teeth are on the outside of the jaw, right? It helps it with the looking very cool and chasing Jeeps, etc. Now, here is a modern depiction of a Tyrannosaurus rex that is up to date with everything we know. So you still have the high forward pointing eyes. We got these ridges on top of its eyebrows. We call those bosses. And, you know, the Jurassic Park T-Rex did that too, but leaning more toward a ruler cool kind of thing. T-Rex had eyes kind of like a wolf. So they're high up on its head and they're both pointing forward. So he could see in 3D, he could see in color, and he could definitely see you if you don't move. But the cool thing is that when we close the jaws of this T-Rex, you can see that the teeth are kept completely on the inside. And these lip structures that you see here are very similar to what we see in things like iguanas and agamas and different kinds of lizards that you might see in your backyard. Like when they close their mouths, they have lips. Now, the Jurassic Park T-Rex closes its mouth very much like a saltwater crocodile. And so a lot of the crocodilians, their teeth are too big for the rest of their heads. There's actually even some species of crocodiles where there's holes that have evolved in their skulls so that their teeth point up through the top of their skulls. It is hardcore to see these creatures. It's amazing. But yeah, so if we start to think of the T-Rex's head as like a Mesozoic bear, and you can see like the big, like jowly lips around it to keep the teeth safe and protected against everything that the environment could throw at them, it just holds up. But yeah, to answer your question about different kinds of reptiles that don't have lips, in the sense of what we're thinking of, I can't think of any on the top of my head outside of like crocodilians.
Well, yeah, no, but the crocodile, totally, that makes a lot of sense. I could see that, you know, those big teeth.
Because they live in water, so they don't have to worry about hydration. And they're not going to dry their teeth out. I have a question for you guys, for everyone here. And it's a question I ask of everybody, and I've let it go far too long without asking this question. We can go around the horn here, so I'll start with Jamie, and then Ashley, and then Liam, and you end us up. What is your favorite dinosaur?
I do love the classic Triceratops. I couldn't tell you why, but they're just awesome. Their horns are awesome.
It doesn't need a reason. Triceratops is one of the coolest dinosaurs that ever lived, ever. They were adorable all their life. Even as a baby, they were fantastic. You ever seen a baby Triceratops skull?
No, actually.
Yes, I have. At the museum of, there's a dinosaur museum in Bozeman, Montana that I just went to. They have like...
Museum of the Rockies.
10, yes, Museum of the Rockies. They have like 10 different sizes of Tyrannosaurus skull. It's so cool. You got to see it.
The whole ceratopsian growth stages, you can see everything from like the massive skulls of the adults to this little adorable thing right here.
Aww.
This is a little baby Triceratops skull. And what I love about this one is that the horns are so small and the frill is like, it's sectional because when they were born, they hatched out of eggs. And as they grew up, their horns grew in distinctive patterns based on nutrition and the environment around them. And their frills became very distinctive as they grew up as well because of the area that they lived in. Now, all these structures are really useful, not just for defense, but more for sexual, you know, selection and for making sure that they're good for looking good. That's the whole thing. If they're any structure that you see on an animal, it's either going to be there for feeding, fighting, or for looking good. So those are the things that you see there on this little Triceratops. I love how narrow the skull is too. Like it would get so massive as they grew up. When we first started discovering Triceratops, every set of horns, we didn't know that the horns were different and that they grew individually as they aged. So we originally had like 30 different species of Triceratops. And then they came along in like the early 1920s and said, okay. Aside from the horns, what's different about them? And then they brought it down to like two. So we had two species. We have Triceratops prorsus and Triceratops auritus. Before that, there were dozens and dozens of them. And then we realized, no, this part changes as they grow up. So just focus on everything else. So yeah, that's a baby Triceratops. Ashley, what's your favorite dinosaur?
Oh gosh, I've been studying for this question ever since we started this. In third grade, my dinosaur report was on Dimetrodon, and I have since found out that that's not a dinosaur. So that's very sad. Although Dimetrodon is still super cool. I don't know how to say it. Quetzalcoatlus?
That's exactly how you say it.
Okay. It's a giant bird. It's enormous, and it like walks around on its elbows. And it has like a super, super long beak, and it's got a very colorful head. It's really weird looking. It looks like it shouldn't be life on Earth, but it is.
It's very bizarre. It's one of the largest creatures that ever flew. And the Quetzalcoatlus, you can see one in full regalia at the Field Museum in Chicago. You can also see the skeleton of a lot of one, and they are just insanely massive creatures. It's a pterosaur the size of a giraffe. And they walked around, like you said, their wings were really powerful, but it was like everyone's creepy uncle from like the 80s, where it's like their one fingernail is like really, really long and they use it to get super high. No, the wings of pterosaurs, they're all just extensions of their pinky finger. Their last digit is so long and it's so well reinforced with the hollow bone structure on the inside and just the engineering look. Like they're all diamond shaped, like triangle shaped bones on the inside that give them that incredible structure. But I'll say this, Ashley, you have a type because Quetzalcoatlus isn't a dinosaur either.
Oh my God. What is it?
It's a pterosaur. So it's what we call a flying reptile. They lived alongside the dinosaurs, but they were not dinosaurs themselves. Dinosaurs had to do two things in order to wear that particular classification. You had to walk with your legs straight down beneath you, and you had to be covered with scales or feathers. If you do those two things, you're a dinosaur. And we start that clock really at the beginning of the Triassic period, because if you go back to the Permian when Dimetrodon lived, you know, Earth and life was still in beta mode. So we were trying a bunch of different things. Dimetrodon is actually closer related to we are than it is to dinosaurs. It's a stem mammal. So if we hadn't had the bigger, badder boom that gave the dinosaurs their shot, we would have potentially evolved from those creatures. And things would have been so much weirder. Because there was a lot of furry reptiles around there. It's crazy. But anyway, so the pterosaurs, they are scaly. They do have scale. We even do find some that have little feathers on them. But their arms, their limbs, their legs sprawl out to the side. Their natural position is to have them out like this instead of straight down. Dinosaurs, even the movie T-Rex, has the legs going straight down beneath it, as does our little buddy Pinacosaurus, who was hiding under his own research. Yeah, so Pinacosaurus, legs straight down, because they need to support their way from underneath.
I've heard this, like, bird-hipped and something else hipped.
Yes. Now, that's another way that we used to classify dinosaurs. We still classify them as that a lot. That's another one that they're kind of rewriting.
Okay.
They're gonna reboot that discussion here soon too. But it got super confusing because we have Ornithischia, which is bird hipped, which includes the dinosaurs that did not turn into birds. And then we have the Saurischia, or the lizard hipped, which includes the dinosaurs that did turn into birds. So it's really kind of it made sense at the time, and now we got to do like this, and it's all backwards, and this puts T-Rex and Brontosaurus in the same family tree, so it's like, it's a weird thing. So we're, more on that as it develops.
Got it. And there's still people who miss Pluto as a planet. I mean, this stuff's changing all the time.
Paleontology is my favorite science because everything is right until it's wrong. All right, Liam, that brings us to you. What's your favorite dinosaur?
So definitely not categorically a dinosaur because it does not walk, but it is the plesiosaur. And I've been every time I say that, people are like, that's not a dinosaur. And I'm like, I know, but it's still cool. I guess proper dinosaur, I'd probably have to go with like Spinosaurus. It's like the T-Rex, but it's got a big fin on the back.
Spinosaurus is one of the best dinosaurs to compare to our modern era because every week there's something new with this thing. Like, it's always changing. It has no idea what it really wants to be, but it's going to become what it believes in. You know what? We have to believe in Spinosaurus because Spinosaurus believes in us. Back a few years ago, Spinosaurus was thought to be just a big land-dwelling T-Rex with a big dragging tail. We had a few specimens that we had found that were on display in the museum in Munich. And that museum was actually bombed during World War II. And that, along with several other important holotype, or this is the example of what this animal looks like specimens, were bombed and blown up by the Royal Air Force. And so, you know, a lot of the research on Spinosaurus had to go away for a while. But then we started to find more and more pieces, and we explored parts of North Africa and like in Morocco, where we find most of the Spinosaurus specimens. And other creatures that are related to it, like other kinds of Spinosaurus, like Baryonyx and Suchomimus and a few other things like that, allow us to fill in the gaps of, okay, it's related to this, so we can compare and kind of copy what they look like to make a sense of it. Imagine if you had to figure out what a Chihuahua looked like, but all you had were coyote bones. You know, you can get a pretty rough estimate of what a kind of a dog it would look like, but still kind of fill in the gaps there. Then we had the idea of Spinosaurus from Jurassic Park 3, where it's this huge carnivore, long crocodile-like snout, but walking on two legs with a long tail behind it. And then a few years after that, Nizar Ibrahim finds an incredible Spinosaurus tail. And now we know that their tail was built for navigating in water. And their bones were super dense to help it stay in the water and stay submerged if it needs to. So we find that Spinosaurus becomes probably one of the first semi-aquatic animals semi-aquatic dinosaurs. It was just as well at home in the oceans and in the rivers as it was on the land. And so it's a dinosaur that keeps changing, and we keep finding new things about it all the time. So it's great. Well, you guys have excellent choices for favorite prehistoric animals. Excellent. Top marks all around.
When you ask people this, what is the rough balance between like Triassic, Jurassic, and Cretaceous?
Mostly I get Cretaceous. The Triassic does not get a whole lot of love, to be honest with you. And I think so many of the creatures that lived in there are just not as well understood as the more famous creatures that we know of. So Triceratops, T-Rex, Ankylosaurus, Velociraptor, these are all Cretaceous creatures. So that's the very end of the dinosaurs. The Triassic is really when dinosaurs first got their shot. You know, the Permian extinction happened. 97% of all life on Earth was obliterated. And then these little reptilian-looking things that knew how to burrow were able to avoid this disgusting fate. And so they came out. They started to take over the world. They all had long limbs, long necks, long tails. Some of them ate meat. Some of them ate plants. They weren't quite sure what they wanted to look like, but they all basically looked the same. And so then, you know, as they started to get a little bit more active, like things like Coelophysis, I think, is probably one of the most famous Triassic creatures because it's the one that we got the beautiful skeleton of from Ghost Ranch, New Mexico, where you see this dinosaur all curled back on itself and like the neck is all twisted. And also we sent it to space one time just to see what would happen. So Coelophysis is a pretty cool dinosaur. But then you get into the Jurassic period. And so now you've got these creatures that are taking over the planet, and they're able to grow so gigantically huge. These long-limbed creatures from the Triassic are like, well, I'm going to eat you. It's like, no, don't eat me. I'm going to start to form thicker hide so that your teeth can't get in. All right, I'm going to grow some large claws so I can tear into that hide. Well, I'm going to put these plates on here for you, so now you can't deal with that. And then it's like, okay, well, I'm going to get really strong teeth as well. So, okay, then I will just become 40 feet tall. So dinosaurs, my favorite evolution book is Dr. Seuss's The Bitter Butter Battle, the Butter Battle book, because it's just point and counterpoint of predators and prey just trying to one-up each other consistently. And that's how life evolves. That's what the process of change for all these things. So you get the Jurassic and you got these incredible creatures like Dilophosaurus, which was the apex predator of the Southwest United States. Like Arizona's T-Rex is Dilophosaurus. And then we've got, Allosaurus and Brachiosaurus and Giraffa Titan, all these massive creatures, not to mention Stegosaurus, of course. And then something funny happened at that point. The dinosaurs were so massive and they were so well proliferating across the surface of the Earth that the planet had to change. They were eating so many plants. These massive herbivores were eating everything in sight. And so the plants go through the same selection processes that everything else does. They started to develop these intricate petals that could attract insects that could get away and explore from one to the next. And so in time, those petals became the way that plants would reproduce with each other. And what I'm getting at is that flowers are an invention that happened because dinosaurs were eating too many plants.
Wow.
And so now we have a blooming and blossoming world that is dealing with these incredible creatures that are so massive, and now they start to really diversify. The big carnivores that had the long arms and claws were finding that if they started to use their jaws more to capture prey, even if things got away, they still got at least a belly full of meat. And so that gave them more time to make baby dinosaurs. So over time, their arms got smaller and their heads got bigger and their tails got thicker to balance that out, which is why we ended up with Tyrannosaurus, with those smaller arms and things that we see there. And the defensive structures on Triceratops and things became so incredible. So as dinosaurs continued on this adventure of life, they became so diverse and so powerful and so awesome that, we gravitate toward the Cretaceous and the Jurassic because that's when they're at their most distinct.
I was going to say, a solid second place for me, or just like a class of dinosaurs, would be the gigantic, like, big, long neck dudes. Because just like, how do you get that big? Literally, how did that happen?
They needed a particular food source, and the ones that they liked were higher up. So they grew larger necks over many, many millions of years and many generations in order to reach their favorite food.
I had a question about, there's a passage that looks kind of hopeful at the right before the methods. They say that we actually might end up finding a lot more of these larynxes, and maybe just the ones we've found so far just were badly preserved. So we might actually like find out a whole lot more about how these dinosaurs made noise.
Absolutely. Yeah, I love that too. Part of the reason that I think it is so hopeful, as you said, and I Ashley, I love the way you said that. It is hopeful because it teaches us something else to be careful about in our preparation. Back during like the Bone Wars and things, when Marsh and Cope were battling it out, trying to name as many species as possible, they didn't care about what was around the bones. They just wanted the bones. And so they got to the point where they were using dynamite to blast these things out of the ground and then load them up onto carts and trains and just get them back to the museum as fast as possible. We actually had a beautifully preserved Carnotaurus skull with skin intact on it. But we didn't know that the skin could possibly preserve at all. So a preparator went in and was like, I'm going to do a great job today, and cleared off all the skin and got it down to the bone.
No.
And we didn't realize it until decades later when someone looked at these old photos and was like, oh yeah, look at this unprepared Carnotaurus skull. And was like, that's not unprepared, that's skin covered. You removed the skin, you idiots. But we didn't know what we were looking for. So now when we find a dinosaur, we find a site, we start mapping it from space now. We use satellite data to track everything. We mark down not just the bones that we find, but we look for bits of other creatures. Like we find turtle shells, we find petrified wood, we find whatever else is around, because we don't just care about the dinosaurs anymore. We want to see the snapshot of their world with them. I mentioned the Field Museum earlier. If you ever get a chance to actually see the exhibit around Sue, the first half of the exhibit is Sue in all of its grandeur. It's an incredible dinosaur specimen. I was not okay the first time I saw this thing. But behind it, there's an entire set of displays. Like, here's everything else we found with Sue. So here's how we know that, you know, it was the spring. Here are some beetle larvae. Here are some centipedes that were building a particular kind of nest. We don't really have nesting centipedes, but here's this. Look at these turtle bones and these, like, these little fragmented bird shells and things like they have here. So we find all these other little bits that tell us the rest of the world. Now that we know that we can find larynx and voice boxes from some of these dinosaurs, we're going to pay so much extra attention to every specimen that comes out to see what other soft pieces might have made it.
Yeah, I lived in Chicago for 10 years. I went to the Field Museum a lot. The thing I just remember is every time you walk in, you can look up and see there's a pterosaur hanging from the ceiling, and it's usually wearing the jersey of whatever team is winning at the time.
I think that you mentioned this, I think the use of the word prepared or unprepared is really interesting, because it sounds like you're going to the butcher at the grocery market and you're like, oh, can I get this like tenderloin prepared for me? And I think it's such an interesting way to refer to something that like we dug out of the ground that is so old and is so like scientifically valuable. We're just like, oh, it's unprepared. Like get all this other stuff out of the way so that we can see like what's underneath it.
Can I use that analogy in the future?
Please.
Because that's brilliant. Because when we talk about preparation, we're talking about once we get the bones out of the rock, we got to get the rock back out of the bones again. And when you go to a butcher shop and you want to get a piece of steak or you want to get a piece of meat prepared in a certain way, I need something because I'm grilling or I'm doing stir fry or I'm doing, you know, I'm baking this or whatever it is. You need it cut in a certain way because of what you're going to use it for. And that's what fossil preparation is. We have different reasons that we're preparing things. So when we get a new fossil in, like, okay, we're preparing this for what? Are we doing this for collections, for future study? Because I use certain kinds of glues to hold things in place. And I preserve as much of the outside matrix as I can so the future researchers can see everything that was part of this. And then we prepare it in a very special way and put it in a very neat, very careful acid-proof container and throw it in the filing cabinet. Or if I'm preparing it for display, I'll use a combination of things, including something called Vinac, which is really just Elmer's glue mixed with acetone. And it forms this really thin glue that just gets saturated into the bones like a sponge sucks it up. And it leaves this really cool sheen on the outside. So it protects these delicate bones in such a way that people will be able to come and see them. They have a nice shine to them, but I can't do much more research with them because it's all now saturated with glue. Or if I'm preparing them for genetic research, which is something that we've been doing a lot of in the last 30 years, I don't use any chemicals at all. Because even a little bit of rubbing alcohol can damage any genetic material that might be found in there. And when we started finding things like collagen and preserved blood inside of the bones of Tyrannosaurus rex, people started asking, so are we going to use this for genetic work? Are we looking for the DNA in this one? Okay, we'll be extra careful. So I love that butcher shop analogy because, yeah, preparation has a goal and a purpose for it. And so we have different methods we use depending on what we're going to use the bones for.
Yeah. And I think it's interesting too. So I did a, I helped do a podcast series on taxidermy, like the history of taxidermy. And I think it's really interesting how we prepare scientific things through a lens of what we think they're supposed to look like. So when we look at that, like, oh, the bones are valuable, the bones are available, throw all this stuff away. And then it's like, we find out later, it's like, oh no, we've been throwing away all this valuable stuff because of what we were able to understand at that point and say, oh, this is what we think is valuable. So this is what we're going to prepare. And like, we're just going to throw all this away. And then I think it's interesting to see how, when we make leaps in technology and like looking at the CT scans, and, you know, being able to 3D print a dinosaur larynx, and now we've got all this interesting stuff. I think it is interesting to see, the biases of how we expect these scientific discoveries to look and how that shapes how we then present them. So I think it'll be interesting to see how this data changes that, and how that starts playing into, like, museum exhibits, or, like we touched on, you know, reference dinosaurs in popular culture and how they sound.
I mean, it completely blew my mind when I found out that the scene in Jurassic Park, you know, the way that you always see in movies where they're just like brushing away the sand from the bone is completely fake, and like rock and bone are basically indistinguishable. It kind of freaked me out and like made me wonder how much stuff in museums is not real.
Is that not how it is? Because I would always go to the zoo as a kid and they'd have a dinosaur exhibit where you would just like play in the sand pit and like brush away sand from fossils. And I thought I was doing something. I thought I was discovering stuff. Is that not how we like discover, something how we like take dinosaurs out of the earth?
So fossilization is a luck of the draw process anyway, because a dinosaur or any other animal from the prehistoric times has to die near water and not get bothered after it's dead. If we can find something that is so well taken care of and not messed with by scavengers, we can occasionally find something known as an in situ fossil. And that is, all the pieces are exactly where they were. Nothing's been disturbed. That does happen from time to time. It's not often. Sometimes it's really cool. There's one called the Fighting Dinosaurs, which is a Protoceratops and a Velociraptor locked in battle, and the Protoceratops is biting the raptor's arm while the raptor's got its claw going into, I'm wearing Jurassic Park socks, while it's going into the neck of the Protoceratops as well. And so, like, you can see these two animals clashing. They died the way they lived. There's another one that's on its way to going on display next year up in North Carolina that is called the Dueling Dinosaurs, and this is a Tyrannosaur and a Triceratops locked in battle for the first time. There's some question as to whether it's a T-Rex versus a Nanotyrannus, but we're not starting that conversation because that's a different, exceptionally polarizing thing. Yeah, those gorgeous in situ finds that you see in movies and in playsets, they happen. They're not often. There's a big Utah raptor block that's got 3 or 4 distinct Utah raptors inside of one close location. It's an incredible piece out in Utah, and they will continue to show more things about that as it comes discovered. But for the most part, when we do find bones, you can see a distinct color change between them. If you're looking for them, you can find some things like where some bones can be darker or lighter than the environment around it. The thing you're looking for is structure, because rocks don't have the same organic textures to them. Like, bone will look like bone. It'll have those striations. It'll have markings. It'll have little pores on it. Teeth are smooth and serrated. Rocks don't do that. Nature doesn't like straight lines. And so when you find something that is organic, you can often find it distinguished from everything else around it. If you get a chance to go on a dinosaur dig in real life, there are a number of places where you can go today and walk out into the field and explore an organic dinosaur farm. My favorite places are like a Wyoming Dinosaur Center, which is it's a farm-to-table paleontology kind of place. There's Jurassic specimens outside of the museum. They dig up these huge sauropods and put them up in museums. If you love Dimetrodon, Ashley, you can go visit my friends at the Whiteside Museum in Seymour, Texas. They'll take you on a dig. They just uncovered. I was out there with them a couple of weeks ago. I found a baby Dimetrodon. We don't find them as babies. I found a baby. I was holding its tiny little sail bones. They were just so adorable. They looked like little figure eight, like little Z-shaped things. It's like if you got a really weird looking piece of linguine, and it's like, well, this one didn't get cut right, but that's a Dimetrodon sailback. So it's such an amazing experience to go out and to to be the first set of eyes to look at this animal that had lived millions and millions of years ago. So it's an experience that I really hope you get a chance to go and see for yourself that sometimes it is like the movies.
Can kids go on these digs, or is it just grown-ups?
You know, the kids can go on the digs too. And sometimes they'll be like, hey, I bet you should dig in that pile over there. And they'll find like little teeth and things like that. But meanwhile, they're like, okay, they're occupied. There's some really exciting stuff in these outcrops right here. So dig around in this area. Here's some aluminum foil and a Sharpie. Let me know if you find something. Here's an oyster knife and a dollar store brush and pan, because those are the tools that we use.
I guess, what do we know about the prehistoric geography of the places where a lot of these fossils are found? I mean, it must have been like big, like bog. Like, what was going on where there's all these fossils?
No, totally. So that's a major part of how they do fossil prospecting in the first place. A lot of people who go into paleontology will start with a geology focus first, because you have to learn how the rocks are speaking to you in order to figure out what you're looking for. My friend Kate, who is she's the groovy geologist on TikTok and Instagram. I got a chance to go digging with her in Texas not too long ago, and just to hear her talk about the different formations and the different layers of the earth that you can see while you're out there, you use that distinctive patterning to figure out how old the dirt is that you're digging into. When you get into a particular formation, that's what we call the geologic areas that go back to a certain date, certain time, certain wildlife is in there, we call that a formation. You can see the color of the rock from miles away. When you look at like pictures of the painted deserts and you see those brown and red striations on the side of a mountain, a geologist or a paleontologist looks at that and they think, oh, that's 30 million, that's 70 million, that's 90 million years old. This right here goes back to the Permian, that's 250 million years old. And so you can start to find all these things that are so intricate and so distinct. And there are some creatures that only lived for a very short, a single page of that chapter of life. And we call those index fossils. So if I find this particular snail, I know a T-Rex is right over there. You know, it's fun to think of those kind of things. So understanding what the geology looks like. And if you look at Google Terrain View, for example, or Google Earth, and you zoom out a little bit, you can see the mountain ranges and you can start to see what looks like rivers and floodplains and things like that. And then you zoom back in and you realize you're looking at a desert. But 60 million years ago, 70 million years ago, that desert was beachfront property. And so that's when we start to think that's a good spot to dig. Because animals would have found that as a water source. They would have been aggregating around there. Good things would have happened. Bad things would have happened. There's probably a piece of ancient life that can tell a story just underneath those rocks. And then you drive for 6 hours and you start digging and you find nothing. But that's just how it goes. For us, we call it Tuesday.
We talked about how this is like a really well-found, preserved larynx. Where we found this dinosaur, does that help us look for other well-preserved larynx fossils?
Yes, it does. And actually, this particular area of Ulaanbaatar in Mongolia has been... it's been difficult for scientists to get into for a while, but it's a place that is relatively untouched over the last 70 million years. So a lot of the things that we see out there are not very different from what they were. Many of these specimens are right near the surface, or they have been really well preserved. We found a creature called Cynosopteryx. We found a kind of a theropod in East Asia where the feathers were so well intact. We also found bits of pigment in the feathers themselves. We saw the fossil had stripes going down its tail. And so we know that this particular dinosaur had an orange body with a white underbelly, black feet, and then white and orange stripes down its tail, like a cross between a raccoon and a velociraptor. And so it's great when we find these areas that are relatively untouched and we are improving our methods and everything, we can find more intact and more well-preserved specimens. And if we're more careful about the process, we can learn more about them too. So we're finding a lot more of eggs with embryos inside. We're finding pieces of more larger dinosaurs with feathers on them. Eutyrannus is a kind of a carnivore. It's a relative of the T-Rex, and it had bristly feathers all down its body. And so we start to find all these different creatures that are changing our perspective, because we can find beautiful specimens and we're taking our time to uncover them.
And I kind of never thought that we would like be able to know what color they were. Like, that's pigment lost to history. Like, definitely not going to hang around. That's amazing.
No, it's an incredible, it's a blending of the art and the science as well. So I've mentioned that Poe is a Deinonychus. When I take her out to events, I have a Deinonychus egg with me. It's about this big. It's about a foot long. It's oval shaped, almost looks like a burrito, but it's teal. Like, it's a deep bluish green, and it's got like little mottled spots all over it. And it's got a really rough texture. Now, I 3D printed it, but when I let people hold it, I say, hey, this is the right size. This is the right shape. This is the right texture. And it's the right color as well. And so when you see modern birds like cassowaries and emus and robins and quails, they all have very brightly colorful eggs. And dinosaurs had very colorful eggs as well. And we don't just guess at that. We know it because when we put those eggshell fragments into an electron microscope, we can find pigment molecules inside the shell, like dried paint swatches. And so when we compare those molecules, we can read what the chemistry is, and we compare that to other modern chemistry we see and say, oh, yeah, this is the code for, you know, Argyle blue. And you know, like, this is the Pantone code for what a Deinonychus' eggshell would look like. And it paints a very vivid, colorful picture of what the dinosaur's life was like. I take her out and I have not a wreath, but like one of those long plant things you can get at like a craft store. And it's like a like twisted rods with like ferns and stuff on it. And so I wrap that in a circle underneath her, and I hide the egg just right on top inside of it. I had 750 people walk past this thing during one recent event, and nobody noticed the egg until I told them about it. The camouflage feature of this teal egg in the greenery that was around at that time worked so well, it even hides them from us.
Wow.
Man, the way that you've explained all this, it's giving me a picture of like how early it seems like our research of dinosaurs has gone, kind of like movies. Like, early movies were black and white and silent, and now we're just getting all this color and all this sound. It's so awesome.
We are in the IMAX era of paleontology now, for sure. So when you read this paper, I love the concept of this show, of taking something really complicated and making it, you know, simple and straightforward. It's part of why I get into doing what I'm doing here. Did you find it difficult to navigate like what they were doing in terms of like the methods? Were any challenges with like the concept of what was going on here?
The methods started, I kind of glossed over the methods just because it started to sound like furniture assembly instructions, you know? It was just like, this is over this, and this is to the right of that, and this is this long. But otherwise, I think it was pretty straightforward, and I kind of, you know, a lot of Googling of terms, but once I did that, I think I pretty much understood it. Until you came along, and then I understood it way better.
Oh, I don't know about all that. I mean, I probably Googled the same stuff you did. But I'm glad. I love that it's an open access article, too. I know that in many cases, publish or perish is still very much a thing. But so many more scientists are encouraging people to get into the discovery field by making their research accessible. So many important discoveries are made by amateur paleontologists anyway. People who go out on these digs for a day and then say, hey, what'd I find here? This is a weird looking thing. And it turns out to be the holotype of Cosmoceratops out in the Grand Staircase Escalante. So it's nice to, we have to keep inviting people into the learning of it, because that's the only way we make new paleontologists in the future.
That is very cool. And I also think a good way to end that, before we go, I know that I think all of you have some things that you would like to promote. So let's start with Jimmy. Where can people find you and your cool work about dinosaurs?
So I am on all social media at Dinosaur Podcast, all one word. And then my website, where you can find out more about the mission of Dinosaurs Will Always Be Awesome, and see how you can actually contribute to helping make some meaningful dinosaur experiences for low-income communities, is dwaba.org. That's D-W-A-B-A, which is short for Dinosaurs Will Always Be Awesome.
That is awesome. That will all be linked in the episode description. How about you, Ashley? Anything to promote?
Yeah. So I'm on Twitter at SmashleyHamer. And at the moment, I'm about to drop season 3 of Taboo Science, but probably when this comes out, there will be a healthy number of episodes of season 3. So you can binge at your leisure. And Taboo Science is at tabooscience.show or on any place you listen to podcasts.
That is super exciting. And I'm betting that listeners of this podcast would also like Taboo Science. So go check that out. And Liam, what are you up to?
Nothing specific to shout out now. I guess just, you know, if you're hearing this, go do something good in your community. Go help someone out, I guess. That's my platform I'll get on right now, I guess. It's just, you know, make the world a little better place.
Fully in support of that. Well, that will do it for this episode. We have been talking about the article, an ankylosaur larynx provides insights for bird-like vocalization in non-avian dinosaurs, and that's by Yoshida et al. Our expert for this episode was Jimmy Waldron, and our guests were Liam Gusios and Ashley Hamer. Our music is by Sam Brunwasser. You can find more of his work at soundcloud.com/visualsnowbeats. As always, you can download the paper and read the transcriptions at inplainenglishpod.org. And make sure to follow us on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram at plainenglishsci. That's PlainEnglishSci. Thanks again for listening, and we'll see you next time for another episode of In Plain English.